But I knew it was wrong in my core. Self-sabotage, it's like I want it, I want it. Tripping on my own by defaults, I want it. Wish I was camouflaged, nobody saw it, I want it. Pretending to act like an adult, I want it, I want it. Self-sabotage, it's like I want it, I want it. Tripping on my own by defaults, I want it, I want it. Wish I was camouflaged, nobody saw it, I want it. Pretending to act like an adult, I want it, I want it. Okay, self-sabotage, it's like I want it, want it. Tripping on my own by defaults, I want it, I want it. Wish I was camouflaged, nobody saw it, saw it. Pretending to act like an adult, I want it, I want it. Self-sabotage, it's like I want it, I want it. Tripping on my own little boots, wish I was camouflaged, nobody saw it, saw it. Pretending to act like an adult. Self-sabotage, it's like I want it.
Night Dreams Talk Radio would like to say a big thank you for listening to Gary and his guest. Gary brings back paranormal talk radio like you remember. Meet the Totally Ninja Raccoons. Three raccoons who become ninjas because they already have the masks. The Totally Ninja Raccoons books are short adventures with quick chapters, specially structured to encourage reluctant readers. Each book has the Totally Ninja Raccoons encountering a cryptid. The monsters are presented in a fun, not so scary way.
I said not so scary!
Readers are encouraged to do their own research and make up their own minds about the possible existence of Bigfoot, the Jersey Devil, aliens, and more. The Totally Ninja Raccoons are available on Amazon or at your favorite bookstore. You can buy autographed copies direct from the author at kevincoolidge.org. That's kevincoolidge.org for the Totally Ninja Raccoons. Knowledge Apocalypse, 10-year anniversary edition, now available. Most ancient cultures speak of a time when their gods visited them. They never say their gods came from across the ocean or from the mountains. They always came down from the skies. Was ancient man visited by gods or extraterrestrials? We have not been told the full truth about our human past. There was a time when all the ancient cultures lived amongst beings they considered their gods. The search for truth leads us down the path of learning where the ETs might come from and why they are here. To understand some of these advanced topics and learn the truth about human origins, buy the new book by Jason Martell, Knowledge Apocalypse, now in its 10-year anniversary edition, available at Amazon.com. Did you know Night Dreams Talk Radio can promote your product or service? And it will be heard by one of the largest audiences in paranormal talk radio. Contact us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com or go to our main webpage and use the contact box at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com.
I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Night Dreams brings on the night worldwide. Did you know you can find us on your favorite app? And now you can watch us live on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to our channel and give us a thumbs up. And now, here's Gary.
And here I am. Well, here it is now, the 21st of February. Time is going fast. Well, in the news, well, Putin is, well, having his military going into certain parts of the Ukraine. We'll see what happens over the next few days. Anyway, also in the news, they found an asteroid with three moons. This is the first time an asteroid has ever been spotted with more than one moon. I didn't even know, James, an asteroid had moons. Did you?
I had heard about one a couple of years ago. It just had one moon going around it. They had a picture of it, but not three. That is compelling. That is very interesting. That goes to tell you we don't have the answers to everything that's out there. We're learning stuff and finding out new things every day.
Oh, yeah. I'm still finding things out about myself every year and every day and every second. Well, also in the news, researchers come up to a conclusion that the Earth could be, well, a being, an intelligent being. The reason why I'm saying this, you know, they thought the center of the Earth was molten lava and molten, iron and all this stuff. Now they found a chamber of something in the center of the Earth. Maybe the Earth is intelligent. Have you ever get that a thought there, James?
I have thought about it because I've heard other theories like that throughout the years that, you know, Mother Earth is its own entity. Quit hurting it, you know, with the things that we do to it. But, yeah, the Hollow Earth, that's a whole big ball game there. That one, I don't know where to go. I think there's a lot to be learned about that because we just don't know. You know, we think there's hot molten in there, but is there really? I mean, you know, think about it.
Well, last week, scientists now come out, they said in the center of the Earth, no, it's not what they thought it was. It's something else. And, well, I don't know. Maybe it's a big computer, right? And we're living in a hologram. Well, you know, a friend of mine, Art Bell, had Mike Malcolm, a time traveler, on his show several times. He actually invented a time machine. And what Mike did is, well, I hate to say it, he liberated these high-powered transformers from his local power company. And what he was doing is creating this high voltage. And he thought this high voltage could transport you back or forward in time. And he actually did some experiments where he put a tool in it and the tool would vanish. And he claimed occasionally it would even come back. Well, he got in trouble, went away in jail for a while for stealing these transformers, came back, and then he started his project again. And then he claimed, well, he got transported to across the country. And a couple years later, he came back as the time difference to the warehouse where he had all his equipment he was building, and it was all gone. Now, I talked to Mike back about 4 years ago. He was going to come on the show, but then everybody's lost any connection with Mike Malcolm. And I'm just wondering if he created another time machine, went in it, and got zapped and vaporized.
That's a good theory because that's what everybody thinks. Where is he? I even went so far, Gary. I knew a guy that knew him and did a little article about him, interviewed him, and he has no clue where he is because he lives in the same town as he lived in. So he just literally fell off the face of the earth, Gary.
Well, you know, if you believe in a flat earth, maybe he did fall off of it. I don't know. By the way, here last week, one of the famous people who was trying to prove that the earth was flat, well, he did an experiment on, national TV, and it didn't go so well. He couldn't prove the earth was flat. Actually, his experiment proved it was round.
Yes. Yeah. And matter of fact, his buddy even spent $20,000 to try to prove it by buying military grade, I forget what they call it, a geo or a gyro. And anyway, it proved that it was, like you just said, the same theory. So he had to go back to the drawing board, but couldn't come out where it was flat. So There we are.
You remember the one guy we had on our show back about 2 years ago claiming that the earth was flat? And he actually, remember his scenario that, ETs, have a huge warehouse that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, or even thousands of miles long. And that we're living in this big warehouse. And, the sun and all the stars are just hanging from the ceiling. You remember that guy?
I do. I even know his name. He was in the documentary, too. And matter of fact, we asked him, about the moon and stuff. And he said they were pretty much like painted on the ceiling, which I thought was a unique theory. None of it matched up or made any sense. But yes, I definitely remember we had him on, and that was a wild one.
Well, come on. The earth isn't flat. It's not round. It's shaped like a box.
A box. Okay. Yeah. You can fall a bunch of corners.
And if you believe that, I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge for $25 too. We'll be right back with a great guest tonight. We're going to talk about Area 51. Then we're going to talk about survival and a whole bunch of other cool things. So stay tuned. You're listening to me, Gary, on Night Dreams Talk Radio Network. We'll be right back. Maybe.
For 80 years, Billy Meyer's UFO contacts have been ongoing in Switzerland with the clearest UFO evidence ever seen. Billy Meyer is also the source of the most accurate, life-saving prophecies and predictions in human history. Suppressed and kept from you for decades, now freely available at theyflyblog.com. And get Michael Horn's newest documentary, From the Depths of Space, on this singularly authentic UFO case at theyflyblog.com. Mention Night Dreams and get a free award-winning film with any purchase. The new film will be out in January. Billy Meyer, Michael Horn, log on now, theyflyblog.com. Did you know Bigfoot? Yeah, Bigfoot is very much alive and well. That's what W.J. Sheehan reveals in his great 9-book series, Bigfoot Terror in the Woods, Sightings and Encounters. His book covers hundreds of Bigfoot accounts from his global archives. The series is available on Amazon in paperback and ebooks. Also, the audiobooks are available on Audible and Amazon. Bigfoot is out there. Also, join W.J. Sheehan on his weekly Bigfoot Terror in the Woods podcast, available on most apps.
Hi, this is Val Von Torn of Metatron Power and Light. You're listening to Gary Anderson and Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Well, thank you, Val. Your voice has made my whole night. Well, James, who's our guest tonight?
Well, our guest tonight is Bob Mayer. Now, Bob is a New York Times best-selling author and a graduate of West Point, and he is also a former Green Beret. Now, he was also an instructor at the JFK Special Warfare Center.
Well, Bob, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Yeah, what part of the country are you in?
I'm in Knoxville, Tennessee right now. We moved here some years ago, and it's currently where we're staying.
Have you, in Knoxville, in Tennessee, have you noticed any difference in the climate? Have you seen any changing of the summers and winters and falls and all that stuff?
Yeah, we're getting a gradual change. The nights have been colder, and we're getting it's a little wetter here. Yeah, precipitation's actually picking up a little bit.
Yeah, I know here it's like fall this year was up here in the Northwest. It was delayed by over a month, which was kind of really surprising. You know, the leaves of the trees normally start falling in late August and early September. It took to like the middle of October. So something is going on. What got you into, Area 51? What do you think is happening there from the start? And what do you think is going on there today?
What got me interested, this was, I guess, 1994, 95, my ex-wife, she was a helicopter pilot from the 101st Airborne, and they were deploying out to the National Training Center in California, Fort Irwin. And she told me that they had to divert around the Nellis Air Force Range to get there in their helicopters. But she also told me an interesting thing. She said the airspace there over Area 51 was as classified as the airspace over the White House. So that got me thinking. I'd never heard of Area 51 before. Most people hadn't back that early. So I started researching, and everything pretty much, I found a lot of stuff went back to Bob Lazar, of course, what he claimed was going on there. So I just kept researching more and more, and then as a fiction writer, I could play with that idea and say, okay, you know, what's out there, and use my military background. Now, my fiction is totally different. What do I think is really out there? Definitely test bed for advanced flight frames. I kind of think, because my background in special operations is, if you know about it, it's not the place, if that makes sense, that really secret things are happening in places you've never heard of. And if you've heard of it, they've let that out for a reason, to kind of divert attention. Area 51, especially in the last 10, 15 years, has really been getting a lot of attention. So my take would be, well, that's a good decoy to send people to different places. But it's definitely very, very isolated when you look at where it's at. Inside the Air Force Range, you don't go there. I don't know if you've ever been out there to Rachel, Nevada, and that whole area, but you don't go there unless you want to go there. It's not on the way to anywhere. To the west of it is the Nevada test site, which you don't want to go through. They set off all the nukes out there. I went out there a couple of years ago with a crew from the Sci-Fi Channel. They wanted to go up the mailbox and up to the gate, and they were all worried about getting arrested, and I was telling them, as long as you don't cross that line, they don't want the publicity.
Years ago, me and my sons, we took our Chevy Avalanche, and we decided we were going to go up and go to that mailbox. Now, this is going back probably 8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago, and we went to that mailbox, and then, there was this road. It just kind of, this was the road, dirt road kind of. So we decided let's figure out where this road goes, not realizing you don't want to go past that last mailbox.
Right.
And it didn't take very long. We saw vehicles coming really fast at us, and we, backed out and turned around and got out of there fast. I was worried about being arrested with two of my sons. It was scary.
Yeah. What was funny was the one time I drove, my wife and I, when we were actually moving across the country to Whidbey Island, we did the detour up that road. I wanted to show it to her, and it's very desolate. And we're driving up the road probably for about 20, 30 minutes. Not a single other car has appeared. And then we see this car coming at us, towards us, and it's like that car in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And the people inside of it were dressed just like that. She had that hat on with the scarf around it. He had a old suit on, and they were just putting along. They went past us, and we're like, okay, well, that's definitely a weird sight. You don't expect to see that. If you're not going to see anything, and then you see this car, it's like I have a time warp coming down the road. It was very bizarre.
It's better, though, than the other type of vehicle with the guns and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, they use that area extensively. I mean, I noticed there's a lot of airfields marked out there, and I know from my training, we used to use abandoned airfields all the time for different type of training things. The Rangers would use abandoned airfields all over the country for airfield seizure training, which was really, that was a wild training exercise to do that with the Ranger battalions.
Well, I'm sure you heard of John Lear, haven't you?
No, I haven't.
John Lear was ex-CIA pilot. I mean, he flew over 130 some different aircraft in his career. But he's the one who got Art Bell to get out of doing political talk radio into the paranormal, you know, UFOs and ghosts and Bigfoot and all that stuff. Him and James, jump in here. Didn't John Lear, with a bunch of friends, they rented a rental car and they took it out to near Area 51, and they, in front of them, had a Huey and with a machine gun, and they had other machine guns, and they took this beautiful rental car and emptied everything into it.
Yes. Matter of fact, it was that festival that they have there in the desert near there every year, a bunch of ufologists and people into that kind of thing. They gather there, and yes, it was in the desert, and they grabbed the helicopter with the big 50
caliber.
Caliber. And yeah, they totally destroyed that car. Trust me on that one. And of course, you know how that goes when you take it back. First thing you probably want to know is the gas tank filled, overlooking all the holes.
Yeah, and the story was that they asked John Lear, well, what happened? I mean, they were in total shock. And he said, well, you know what? You just don't park on certain parts of the streets in Las Vegas.
That could be true. Yeah, we used to, the ranges at some of the posts I was at, some of the things we shot at were pretty much on the edge. And especially if animals wandered into it, you didn't want to. And they paid down at Fort Hood, they paid the cattlemen a certain amount of money every year for, because it was open range, anything that wandered into the kill zone. That was a live target.
Well, you know, Bob, a lot of people out there have wrote books, for example, saying that Area 51 has all these secret underground to the base, and that there's supposedly a tunnel coming from the California coast, where UFOs and submarines can go through and then go to Area 51. I don't buy that.
That's a little bit much. They definitely have things underground there. One of my premises for my novels was, instead of, you know, Area 51 picked because of its location, Area 51 was picked because something was already there. And they discovered it during World War II, because 1942 is when Nellis Air Force Base opened up and they started using the ranges out there. So I turned it around and said, no, they built all this around at the test site, the Nellis Air Force Base range, to protect something they found at Area 51. But in reality, that would be a hell of a tunnel to get that far. I liked when you in the introduction, you were talking about, just kind of weird, you know, the Earth being intelligent. Actually, my last Area 51 book, Earth Abides, which came out, I think, a year ago, that was the premise, that the Earth actually is sentient in a way. That's 13 books into the series and the big arc, and it's complicated, but it sort of came down to that.
Well, you know, I was just reading this journal, science journal, and, you know, here just recently, you know, they've been saying that, you know, the center of the Earth has a core of, you know, iron, nickel, and all this stuff at high temperature and all this stuff. Now they come out and said, well, there's an area in the center of the Earth is void of all that stuff. So
when I was researching, I was shocked. I mean, you've used a phrase I use a lot with all my writing, is we don't know as much as we think we know. Because I started doing that research, and I remember what I was taught in school about the core of the Earth, and, you know, and I kept finding stuff saying, we really don't know what it's made of, because nobody, you know, the deepest boreholes in Russia, and that barely scratches the outer crust. So all we're doing is working off of data that can be interpreted a lot of different ways.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Bob Lazar, you know, his story, he claims that they were back engineering UFOs and stuff like that. Again, I don't know. I've talked to some famous scientists in the past and asked this question. If you went back in time, Bob, to 1950, mm-hmm. for example, I'll just pick that out at random, and you go up to the smartest scientist, you know, who's into electronics, and you say, here's this device, which happens to be your cell phone. Do you think they had the capability in 1950 to re-back engineer that cell phone?
No, I don't think so. They could figure it out, but I don't think they could back engineer it, because it requires so much other technology step by step to build up to it.
Yeah, that's the part of, you know, with the part of supposedly crash UFOs. the technology would be so far advanced. I just don't think we could back engineer it. I mean, that's, you know, maybe if they have one that hasn't been damaged, you know, like a 1959 Edsel, that it worked, maybe they could get it to do something. I don't know.
I think the technology would be so far past what we would be able to figure out. I mean, that's actually the premise of the first book, is that, you know, they found this mothership there and they're like, you know, well, let's test it out. And there's a guy going, I don't think we should turn that thing on. And that's pretty much the whole fight of the book, is the people who want to turn it on, the people saying it's a bad idea to turn this thing on, because we really don't understand the technology. We don't know who left it here. We don't know what turning it on does. And of course, they do turn it on, and it turns out to be a bad idea.
Yeah, it sounds like it. How would you turn it back off? Sometimes turning something on is easier than turning it off.
I always liked the story out at when they did Trinity tests, that the scientists, they were waging bets on, you know, how big the explosion would be. And there were some people betting, you know, well, it's going to ignite the entire atmosphere and wipe out the Earth. And you're thinking, well, what if you win the bet? I mean, that's kind of not the best idea. But there were some people betting on that. They really didn't know exactly. They had a good guess what was going to happen when the bomb went off. But there were a lot of unknown factors, and they were under a lot of big rush to get that thing done.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, too, around Area 51, you mentioned that there was a test bed there for nuclear devices from what? From the 50s to the 60s, where they were dead?
The Nevada test site is, I think, 708 nuclear devices were detonated there, most underground. It looks like the moon. If you look at satellite images of it, it looks like the surface of the moon.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the reason why I'm saying, there's a guy out of Las Vegas who's really, his images, his videos are viral on YouTube and on Facebook and a whole bunch of area. He claims, and I've had him on the show, that he goes out like virtually every weekend and he can get UFOs, captures them right flying around the hillsides of Las Vegas. And after I had him on my show, it really intrigued me what he was saying, because, I mean, and I looked at a lot of his images. I've been on a lot of helicopters, and I'm sure you have, if your ex-wife used to fly them. You know, when they've been hovering, and then they go to take off, there's a dip, and then it comes up. And I was looking at all these videos of all these hundreds of UFOs he was getting through the years. And I got really frustrated. So the first thing I did is I called the tower of the International Airport in Las Vegas. And naturally, I knew what they're going to say, and I talked to the head person, and they said, look, if there were UFOs around here, we'd be locked down. No planes would be coming in and going out. So he gave me the number and a person to talk to at the Air Force Base. And he said, look, I'm going to give you another number, because what is going on around there is helicopters. A couple times a month, they're going around the hillsides around there looking for radiation from, you know, around, you know, what was going on the other side from all the detonation of nuclear. They're keeping track to see if any of that stuff is migrating. And so this guy was getting all these videos at night, and they weren't UFOs, they were helicopters.
Well, it's like the black helicopters. You know, I used to hear about them all the time. And then one night I was flying with we were there when the Night Stalkers started up Task Force 160. The unit after Desert One failed, and they formed that special helicopter unit. We were there on the ground floor building them up. And one night I was flying wintertime upstate New York, and there were two Black Hawk helicopters. And the Black Hawk is very different than the Huey. That was one thing. It flew, a lot faster, gained altitude a lot more. And all of a sudden I realized, wait, we're in the black helicopters here. You know, we had the refueling pods in the front, and we had to land in some farmer's field in the middle of nowhere. And I'm thinking, if someone sees this, all they're seeing is these blinking lights, this blur of snow blowing in the air, these guys with night vision goggles on, if they could even see us at that distance. You know, and they'd be wondering what's going on. And really what we were doing is, I had the map in the back helicopter, how to bring it up to the front helicopter, because they didn't have a map. I mean, it wasn't as sophisticated as people think it is.
Oh, yeah. I could imagine a lot. Oh, boy, they're the men in black, or they're ETs, and look at them. Anyway, hey, Bob, we need to take a break, and let's talk about, well, evasion, survival, and all that stuff when we come back, okay?
Sure.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
We'll be back with Bob right after this. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Are you searching for deeper answers when it comes to experiences with the Sasquatch and other cryptids? One man who seems to be taking that deeper dive is Ron Moorhead. His incredibly clear, scientifically vetted Bigfoot Sierra sounds will send shivers. In addition to these recordings, he's written two books, Voices in the Wilderness, which is the chronicle of interactions that went on for years up in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and then his latest, The Quantum Bigfoot, where he bravely goes where others fear and takes it head on, again, backed by science. The disappearing tracks, the pixelated images, and the screams in the dark. All of this and more can be found at ronmoorhead.com. That's www.ronmoorhead.com. Night Dreams Talk Radio brings back Bumper Music Fridays from emerging new bands. If you'd like to have your band's music played as bumper music on Night Dreams Talk Radio, it must be an original piece of music you or your band wrote, and you must give us a release to use it on air. Contact us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com or go to our show's website at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com and click on the message box. Do you remember how great paranormal talk radio was in the 80s and 90s? Night Dreams Talk Radio brings back to you talk radio like you remember, with your host, Gary Anderson, broadcasting to you live from his secret compound deep in the great Northwest. Now, here's Gary.
And here I am. Well, you know what gets me? What happens if we end up at some point with terrorists or a nuclear war or something happens and you have to get out of your city? Now, depending on where you live, I mean, certain parts of the country, it would be no problem to get away. But any major city like L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, Tacoma, you know, where you have to go onto a major freeway to get to the mountains, it would be really almost impossible. And Bob, I got to ask you a question. What should a person do if they can't get away? If they don't have a helicopter or a plane to, you know, get out of their house, what are they going to do?
Well, that's the thing. There's ways of getting out of places. Literally, I just wrote that book. It's coming out Thursday, called The Greenbury Area Study. And I've done these with people, area studies. And what that is examining your environment for your threats, for your assets. But also, you're looking for routes of transportation, evacuation routes. I mentioned I use Seattle as an example. My son lives in San Diego. Seattle is very... can be cut off very easily from the rest of the country. There's only a few roads to the mountains to the north. I-5 to the south is even to be cut off relatively easily. But there are other ways through. Here in where I live in Knoxville, you know, we're in the Tennessee Valley. There's only two paved roads through Smoky Mountain National Park. But I get around that all the time because I know where the National Forest roads are. I worked with a client in New York City, and four of the five counties of New York City are islands. So there's a big concern in New York City of getting out of the city, and there's so many people. But I found things like there's 10,000 miles of tunnels under New York City. Nobody knows all of them. There's the old Croton Aqueduct that you could walk from downtown New York City 23 miles north and come out there. And this has been abandoned. There's the Hellgate Bridge, which is rail only. People don't think of that. You can use a rail only way to walk your way out or take a motorcycle or bike your way out of New York City. Nobody else would be thinking of taking that route on the rail line. So there's ways to do it, but the key is you have to sit down and study it. And most people haven't thought through, what if I do have to evacuate and everybody's crowding onto the main roads, of course? What are my alternatives? And there are always alternatives.
Yeah, but, you know, again, you know, when something happens, people panic really easy. And then their mind doesn't think. The only thing they think, well, gee, I got me, my wife, and my kids. We got to get out of here. So they get into their car. They inch out of their neighborhood, which who knows how long that would take. And then they get on the intersection, and then it's gridlocked. And they're not going to get out.
All right. That's why I'm so – my biggest focus on everything is to be prepared, to think things through and to have a plan. And it's not only knowing the route. It's like you have to have a list, because you're right, people will panic. You have to have a list of, what do I grab? You know, of course, you got your grab-and-go bag, but every room of the house, you should have a list of, these are the things we take. Because you don't have time, you don't have the ability to sit there and think these things through. I'm also a fan of having, you know where you're going, you have your hindsight. You also have, can put caches in. People don't even think of that, but like my son in San Diego, we have a spot we'll meet up on, and there's water there, cached there, because that's a priority down where he lives in the Southwest. Right here where I live, water is not a priority. We got tons of water everywhere. Filtering it is important, but so every area of the country has a unique thing to it. And one of the fun things by writing the area study book was thinking that through for different parts of the country.
Yeah, that is, you know, the part though that, you know, being prepared, you know, even if we didn't have a terrorist attack or something, we got hit by a grid, you know, a solar flare, mm-hmm. and our grid goes down. Most people don't even have enough food to survive more than a week or so in their pantry. Most people don't have enough water. They don't realize you need a certain amount of water to survive per day, you know, each day, not just for drinking, for, you know, cleaning your, you know, dishes or even flushing your toilet, because you can only go so long without flushing that toilet, you're not going to be in that house.
Yeah, most people don't know the priorities of things. My priority is always water. Water is, you know, first day I have a survival book, preparation and survival book, and the first page, task number one says, right now, just go get 2 cases of water per person in your household. You don't have it, get it, throw it in a closet. And that's real base level stuff. That'll keep you going for 3 days. Most people don't even have that. Because, you know, 80% of all natural disasters are accompanied by water failure. Your water system's going to go down. It's going to be contaminated. There is, and that's the key. If you're prepared, it's not just to be prepared. It gives you peace of mind. You're not as worried about things. Because I know most people every once in a while think, well, what if? You mentioned the power grid. I'm working with a company that's producing a really high-end video. And it scared me watching the test video. I mean, I thought I knew about it. But they were talking about all the ways the power grid can go down and how close we've come at times to losing it. And if we lose it entirely, we're in deep trouble. I mean, there were things pointed out in that I had to really reconsider and think, this is a very precarious situation, the power grid.
Well, just think how many people will perish the first week and then, you know, several weeks later without power. And, you know, again, the CIA did a report here about a year or two ago. If our grid system went down, you know, there'll be little pockets, you know, that they'll get up in certain areas. But getting the whole grid system back up could take a couple years.
Yep, because the transformers, the big transformers are made in China. And we don't have backups. And to move a transformer, I watched a video of them moving these huge transformers. It's unbelievably hard. If we lose 3 or 4 of the huge transformers, a whole section of the country is in big, big trouble. And you mentioned EMP, but also sabotage. Cyber warfare can put us offline. The Chinese have tested that a couple of times in California, taking down the power grid. The only reason they don't do it is we'll do it back to them. It's like sort of a mutually assured destruction. But I think that's probably the number one threat right now is the power grid.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to invade a country or take a country down, take out their grid, I mean, you know, the country would just be in total chaos. I mean, you're not going to have a transportation unless you do have a 59S or a Model A out there. Your current automobile isn't going to start. Trucks aren't going to start. You're not going to get food into the warehouses. The warehouses isn't going to get food into the store. You're not going to have any money because nothing on the internet is going to work because that's all out. The banks aren't going to be open because it would be just total chaos. And again, what do people really need? I mean, having, you know, these dollar and $10 and $20 bills and $100 bills are going to be, aren't they going to be worthless at that point? Don't you need gold, silver, something, you know, a couple generators in your, you know, garage to trade?
I don't think gold or silver or money is going to be important if in a catastrophe that big. I mean, medical supplies. Actually, I'm a big fan of knowledge. You need, you know, doctors, soldiers who understand tactics, engineers. You need people who help rebuild. Gardeners. I'm a big fan of gardening. I'm also a fan of solar. I've started on my own a little bit, but just for the basic essentials of things, renewable energy. It's a question of thinking it through. Like we were talking about the Pacific Northwest. You know, when I lived on Whidbey Island, one of the things I liked about Whidbey Island was I realized, you know, we got the ferries, but you can stop those. If they take out Deception Pass, that island's self-sustaining. You know, they got enough farms there. They got all that. And, of course, people from Seattle will try getting on it. But by itself, that island could self-sustain. And I think that's something people need to think about, especially if you're in a big city. Where are you going to go? Because the locals aren't going to – I've never got deployed anywhere in the world where the locals didn't find me. Eventually, I've been in the most remote locations, hunkered down in a hide site, and sort of like in Lone Survivor. There's always that goat herder or somebody that walks up on you.
Well, it's good to have a bug out place in case something ever went where you can go where you feel you're going to be safe. And, you know, again, like I was talking to a friend back last year, he said, well, I got two generators. I got enough, you know, fuel, you know, to keep it going for a couple months. You know, and I said, well, you know what? If you fire up those generators, if there is a grid outage, you're not going to have that generator very long or anything nope. else.
I'm not a big fan of the, you know, the bunker mentality. I'd say the poor man's survival guide is find your local survivalist. And, of course, they all think they have their guns. And I'm also a fan of what I call the inverse rule of security. The more security you need, the less secure you are. Actually, I'm not even a fan of going to a specific spot. I have a bunch of spots, and I just say keep on the move. Because the minute you stop, you become a target. It's been an extreme emergency. The goal is to stay away from people as much as possible.
So I
like you just said about the generator, because I've had power outages at my last house. I had a whole house generator, and everything's quiet, and you can hear a long way when somebody's, you know, whole house generator kicks in.
Oh, yeah. You know, where I'm at in Gig Harbor, Washington, 20-some-odd years ago when we bought the property, we moved over here, and then, you know, our power comes from Tacoma. It goes over to the peninsula to us, and we had a power outage from a storm. It took pretty close to 2 weeks before they could restore it. And I had a good-sized RV. You know, like a diesel, you know, big rig, which, you know, I had the generators. I had plenty of fuel. I had propane. So I told my wife and family, hey, we're just going to go into the RV. We'll put out the slide outs. We had the TV. We had everything. And the first night, it was really nice. The second night, we started getting bangs on the door. People saying, hey, can we hang out in your RV? We're cold, because it was the middle of winter. And next thing I know, I mean, you know, we had like three or four other families hanging with us because they had no heat. They had no way to, you know, have food. And that's what this tells me. If it even got worse than that, you wouldn't even have the RV. Somebody would say, I want it.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing people don't really think through. I mean, I think they fantasize about it. But, you know, having been in real world situations where things got serious, and, you know, you've probably been in the same thing. It's a whole different ball game when people are desperate and you have to make these hard decisions. And it's not as easy as people think it is.
Well, yeah, you get in a situation where you have a wife and kids and, you know, they're hungry and you're worried about their survival. And then, you know, society, it doesn't take long. I hate to say it. A certain element of the society will start breaking down. And it, again, I'm just using this as a grid, goes down from a terrorist attack or from a nuclear war, which I hope never will happen. It wouldn't take long before society breaks down. I had a guy would tell me, oh, it would not. And I said, do you know, think back and research Watts in L.A. and see what happened in that area. It broke down.
Yeah. Well, the example I always use, one of the hardest deployments we had was Bosnia. You know, what's really bothered a lot of guys there was to see how quickly the facade of civilization was gone. I mean, most Americans don't understand. You're about 5 to 7 days away from that facade being ripped away. Law and order can break down extraordinarily fast, especially if you don't have basic supplies.
Wow, that's it. I mean, even law enforcement would start breaking down. I hate to say it. I was in the military. It's going to, even if it was a prolonged period of time, you're going to find even military people, they have families. And that is going to become more important to them than, you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing at one point.
Well, that's one of the things I think that most people, even here when you have disasters, you always get help from the outside. No matter how bad it is, some, you know, crews coming from outside the area. And people really need to think through, what if nobody comes? And that's why I'm so big on preparation. I mean, yeah, I've talked about survival and this and that, but to me, the best survival is to be prepared. You know, I'd rather use a lighter to start a fire than, you know, figure out how to use a stick and a bow. I mean, that's, to me, you know, there's a whole phase I talk about scavenging that people don't really think about in terms of survival. There's a whole art to scavenging. And you have to prepare for that too. And you have to, that's part of the area study. You know, you're not going to go to the local grocery store and local pharmacy where everybody's crowding in to get stuff. You've got to figure out where the warehouses are in your area, where further up the supply chain, where you can go that other people won't think of going.
Well, that is the problem, because, again, if something happened, yeah, that supply chain is going to stop and the warehouses are going to be empty really fast. The grocery stores, we already saw that here, you know, and with toilet paper, you know, you couldn't even get toilet paper at one point because of COVID. And people were fighting over toilet paper, shoving people down, yanking stuff out of their hands. It just tells you how fast, even over that, how people react.
I wrote an article the other day about exactly that topic, why people were hoarding toilet paper, which actually is kind of stupid on the big scale of things. And it's really because they don't know what else to do. They really don't know what should I be doing. No one's telling them what should I be doing. So they think, well, I'm just going to grab this. This is here. This looks like something I need, obviously. And they pile their cart full of it when actually there's a lot more important things they should be putting in that cart. But again, if you don't know what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, even with COVID, you know, it seems to be, you know, I'm just recovering from it myself. You know, the thing is, now they're saying that there could be another one, even worse, just right around the corner.
Oh, there will be. You know, I wrote 20 years ago, I wrote a whole book about a pandemic, but I have a bunch of free slideshows on my website for people about survival, and I titled it The Inevitable Pandemic. And this one was bad, but there's a good chance, I'd say a 50% chance, we're going to have a much worse one in the next 20 years. That's why, you know, people should be stockpiling N95 masks and things like that, because no matter what you feel about COVID, there'll be another one, and it will probably be worse.
Yeah, besides stocking for stuff like that, what should the average person, let's say they got a wife and two kids, how much food do they need to survive? And how, if they can't get in through that tunnel in New York, or they can't get up to the mountains up here in Washington State to get out of the area, let's say they're trapped, I mean, how much food should they have? How long should they plan for if they, you know, because let's face it this way. When we had that power outage for those 2 weeks, I had a 3/4 beef in two freezers, you know, and when the power came on, guess what happened? I had to get rid of all that. So everything in the freezer was not eatable. So, I mean, anything you guys have in your refrigerator, freezer is not going to last very long. And how much food do you need, and how long should you plan for not being able to go out and get food?
Well, again, it goes back to I break my book down into three levels of emergencies: a mild, moderate, and extreme. And I tell people, first, prepare for mild. You know, that's the power goes out for 2-3 days, and, you know, something mild that is going to happen. Be prepared for that first. Get your 2 cases of water. Food is not that big a priority for a couple of days. You know, you can go 3 weeks without food. You don't want to, but you could in an absolute emergency. But then moderate and extreme, you start thinking, all right, what more do I need? You mentioned MREs. I go with Mountain House, which used to make the LRPs, long-range patrol meals we had in Special Forces, freeze-dried food. I use it camping. I cycle through my food that way. You know, I always go through the older stuff. I've got survival bars. Everybody's situation is different, Drew. I keep going back to the area study. You got to look at, do you even have food growing? You know, we always have a good garden going in the summer. Can you hunt? I'm a favor of not hunting with snares. They're quiet. You can put a lot of them out. You only got about 10% rate, but if you put out 50 or 60 of them, you're doing pretty good there. So there's a lot of things that go into it. And that was what was really hard about writing my area study book and my survival book, was there's so many variables to this. And you can't think of them all, but you have to look at all your possibilities and then see what your priorities are. I tell people, list your top 5 threats and prepare for them in that order.
How about evading the whole, you know, to get out, to evade, or what should a person do to prepare to, well, the other way to protect yourself by evading?
You know, that's a hard one because, like I said, my A team, we'd be out there in the middle of nowhere and someone would find us, but really go where people won't go. Don't go to the obvious places. Like right here, Knoxville, Atlanta's on the other side of the Smokies. You know, people from Atlanta are going to go up into the Smokies. So I'm not going to go south towards those people. I'm going to go up towards Oak Ridge, which you really don't want to go to in a way. But there's a huge federal reservation up there. Go to the places where, and that's the hard part. It's a trade-off, though. You know, you're going to the place that people won't think of, won't go to. But I also point out to people, even in a big city, there's what I call dead spots. I grew up in the Bronx. And off the top of my head, I can think about 4 or 5 places just blocks away from my house where you could actually hide. And if you have supplies, you could spend a week or two there and no one would know you were there. Again, it gets back to looking at the world around you a little bit differently, looking about it in terms of what can go wrong and what am I going to do if that goes wrong? How am I going to take care of my family?
And that is the important thing. How about weapons and stuff? I know you're not a big fan of weapons, but... Again, I look at, it doesn't take long with things breaking down. Somebody's going to come knocking at your door and they're going to want what you have in your pantry, for example. They're going to want your food. And if you're dumb enough to have been running a generator, they're certainly going to take that from you. So wouldn't having some weapons and ammunition and survival equipment that way too be a smart move?
Yeah, I think a basic level. I mean, the bottom line on a weapon is you're going to fire one gun at a time. Okay, that's why all these people have these huge collections. I touch on, and I basically said you need basically 3 or 4 types of weapons, plenty of ammunition. A 22 is always great because you can get tons of ammo, but that's for hunting, and it's relatively quiet. The thing about the defending thing is, I mean, that's an all or nothing situation. And again, most people have not been in a life or death situation. You know, the old adage of don't pull a gun unless you're going to use it. And if you're going to use it, you know, all bets are off. It's a life or death situation. I definitely believe you should be able to defend yourself. But I prefer to run away and live another day, which is why I'm not a big fan of sitting in one place. I would rather leave, even give up some things if I had to, because once you have a confrontation, it's going to escalate really fast. And I think people overestimate how much they're going to need in terms of that if everything goes to hell. But then again, what kind of hell are we talking about? You know, how bad is it going to get? How extreme, how desperate are people going to get? They're going to get pretty desperate if they have to take care of their families.
Well, it doesn't even have to be a terrorist attack or a nuclear war. It could be another pandemic that it is so bad it kills off a large percentage of the population.
If we get up to, I mean, even just a 10% pandemic, everything will break down. It doesn't need to be massive until, if we lose 10% of the population, we've seen the supply shortages from COVID, which is, you know, 0.5. If the kill rate and transmission rate goes up, say, 5 times that, which is still relatively low, we're going to have severe problems.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I don't know how it is where you're at, but here on the West Coast, you go into a store and you look on the shelves and they're not full anymore. You can't go in there and choose, well, gee, I want this brand pork and beans. I mean, you're lucky if you find a can of pork and beans, let alone you don't find 3 or 4 or 5 different brands. I mean, you never know what type of meat you're going to get or anything. And it's getting kind of scary, and it's getting more and more this, where the store shelves are getting a little bit more emptier all the time.
Any major city is 5 days away from running out of food. If you talk to people in the food industry business, that's why I'm a fan of, you know, freeze-dried meals for a couple of months to at least get you through to the point where you can be self-sustaining, either in scavenging, gardening, hunter-gathering, things like that. Again, it depends on your skills. Can you hunt? Can you gather? Do you know what plants you have in your area? Do you know what's edible? What crops are grown in the area? What wildlife you have? What's dangerous? All those things. And again, it goes back to, you know, I actually did the area study, and I put it in an appendix in the book to show people an example of actually doing one. And it was eye-opening for me to do it, even though I knew the area pretty well. I had to do a lot of research and dig into things to find out, you know, what exactly is around me? What can I use? What can I eat? What, you know, what's dangerous out there?
Oh, yeah, too. You know, and if depending on where you're at, if you decide to go out in the mountains or go whatever, you know, then you have to worry about, like here, rattlesnakes and all this other stuff once you go up to the mountains on the other side. Again, I don't know. It's a situation I hope we never have to go through. But again, there's so many things. Like I said, another major pandemic that is way worse than what we have could cause the, you know, the food chains to just totally dry up. That is scary. Also, a lot of people don't realize we're going into inflation really big time. Now they're talking about hyperinflation and what's going to happen if there's not enough money to buy food. They already said the average person in this country now, depending on how many dependents you're supporting, the average man and wife and 2 kids are now spending more than $300 more for food than they were here a month ago.
Well, the good thing, though, is people adapt. I mean, we think we can't do without a lot of things. You know, I actually hear people going, oh, I couldn't live without the internet. I couldn't live without this. And yeah, you can't. You human beings are remarkably adaptable. I got a friend, he's a 96-year-old ex-Marine. And that's his thing. His thing is like, you know what? We've been through a lot of things in this country. And he says, we will prevail because we will find a way to deal with things and come back even stronger. So I do kind of believe in the power of the human spirit. And that's the one intangible that I think a lot of people have not been tested on. You know, when we put people through SEER training or we put them through, you know, some of these other courses at the JFK Center, that's what we're looking for. How do you react in an emergency? That's how we weed people out. And you don't know until you're in an emergency.
Oh, you're right. Hey, our time went by so fast. How can they, do you have a website or anything you can share? And what's the latest book?
My website's bobmayer.com, BOBMAYER.com. My latest book, I had a book come out today on 21 great disasters in history and how they happened. And Thursday, I've got the area study book coming out. And I'm really excited about that because it is the precursor to my preparation survival guide. And I think if you do the area study, you will feel a lot more comfortable and you will know a lot more about your situation.
Again, and where are the books available at?
On Amazon is primary place to go get them, ebook or print book.
Well, hey, I want to thank you so much for coming on. I learned a little bit more, and I didn't know that you could go from one end of New York and get out of the New York City like that. It tells me that, you know, there is ways for people to get out of a major city in a disaster. My friend, again, everybody check out his website, check out his books on Amazon, and I want to thank you for coming on tonight.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Okay, you take care, my friend. Now, James, we got a really good show here tomorrow, don't we?
We do. We have Andrew Bisagi on. He's the lawyer who, as a kid, did some time traveling all over, like Gettysburg and seen Washington, and that's going to be a great show tomorrow night.
Oh, yeah. Actually, this attorney was on Coast to Coast with Art Bell a couple of times. He claims that the military group he was associated with doing these time travel stuff and teleporting, he was teleported to Mars, where we supposedly had a base. And one of our former presidents was there when he was a young child, and he met Obama there, supposedly. It's going to be a great show tomorrow, and you want to make sure you catch it. And tell your friends about us. You can catch us again on all the major apps. We're on YouTube, and here in about a week, we'll be on TikTok, too, live. So you can catch us on TikTok. So that's going to be interesting. And we're over everywhere. I mean, we are everywhere. And I want to thank all the people out there, like Barb and Rory and everybody out there that, you know, is on chat and, you know, is loyal listener. Well, till tomorrow, everybody, you have a good one. And by the way, I just want to say we will be going on as of next week. We're 7 days a week with the show. And starting next Monday, we'll be on the full hour and a half instead of an hour on Mondays. And if you just didn't realize it, normally we're not even on Monday. So today was the first day doing a Monday just to get people, you know, ready for what is going to be in the future. Well, everybody have a good one. We will catch you on the other side of the coin.